Welcome to Melungeon Voices, presented by the Melungeon Heritage Association. My name is Liz Malone, and I'm joined by my usual partner in crime, the president of the Melungeon Heritage Association, Heather Andalina. Heather, how are you today?
I am doing very well. How are you, Liz?
I'm wonderful. And again, awesome to be in the studio with you.
Yes, face to face.
So for this week's episode, Heather, you had a very intriguing conversation with Jake Richards. I personally was very curious to hear what he had to say based on just reading about his description and what the subject matter would be. So why don't you fill us in a little bit about Jake and what your conversation entailed?
Sure thing, Liz. Jake Richards grew up and currently lives in East Tennessee. He is the author of two books, one published just a few months ago. Jake writes about his Melungeon and Cherokee traditions and ancestry, which are on both sides of his family. His Melungeon ancestors came from both Newman's Ridge and the Peedee River migrations. In this episode, Jake shares his fascinating knowledge of Appalachian folklore and magic, as well as some interesting spiritual traditions connected to the Melungeon people.
That's awesome. Let's take a listen.
All right. Well, I'd like to welcome to the Melungeon Voices podcast, Jake Richards. Hi, Jake.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing good.
All right. Well, let's get into it. So would you share with us a bit about your Cherokee upbringing and what it was like?
Well, it's a little bit confusing because my father's side has always been like extremely adamant that, you know, that we were always Cherokee, even though, you know, it wasn't technically like enrolled or anything like that. So they were always adamant to like take me to the local powwows, you know, tell me the stories and everything like that. And my mother's side of the family, they kind of backed it up as well, even though they only said that, you know, my mama Sadie, they would only say that she was half Indian and that her father was full-blooded Indian, but they only ever said Indian, and it wasn't ever, you know, like tribe specific, which I always thought was kind of weird. So like from the very, you know, beginning or whatever, you know, where I was always confused as being Hispanic or, you know, anything like that, you know, that was the only thing that I had to, I don't know, I guess like lay claim to that, you know, that's, you know, that was my identity, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yes. You know, and it's interesting because we too, my grandmother was told, you know, we had Cherokee. So the same with us. So how did you first learn about your Melungeon ancestry?
Well, I mean, my family, well, my mother's family, not my father's family, has always been like big on the, you know, spiritual, like Appalachian beliefs and, you know, dreaming true, like gifts and things like that. Well, it happened, I don't even know how many years ago, but it was a long time ago. I started having these recurring dreams of, I was in a dark forest somewhere, and there was a bonfire something going on, and there was a bunch of people around it. But there was one man who was standing in front of me, you know, like a kind of like a silhouette or something like that. And he kept shaking me by my arm, by my shoulders, saying, find us, over and over. And I had that dream over and over for like, I think like 6 months. And then finally I was like, you know what, I'm going to, you know, look into this whole, you know, Cherokee story to, you know, try and figure it out. Mm-hmm. So that's when I started looking through ancestry.com and everything. And I was checking roll after roll, and I wasn't finding any names. I wasn't finding anything that would, you know, document their Cherokee claims. Because they always said that they came from somewhere near Raleigh, North Carolina. But documentation-wise, I can't trace them outside of Sullivan, Tennessee. It only goes back to, I think, 1830 on that line. But it kept confusing me because I kept seeing, you know, all these people who were, you know, in one census marked as white, another census marked as mixed, or another census marked as black. Mm-hmm. And it always varied between the different family members. So like one family member would consistently be marked as white, another one, you know, theirs would change all the time. So I was like, okay, so what am I doing wrong here? And then, you know, the same thing happened with my mother's line. I could only take it back to my fourth great-grandfather, Tennessee Adams, and it was just a dead end from there. So that's really how it happened for me, I guess. And then I don't remember exactly when I started thinking that it was, you know, possibly Melungeon or anything like that. But I know that I heard the, you know, like the word Melungeon from my father years ago. There was this song that used to play on the radio back in like 2005. It was like early 2000s. And it was, you know, talking about being a red bone. And it apparently said the word Melungeon. I don't remember the word Melungeon because my daddy used to sing it whenever we was, you know, driving in his truck that he had at the time. It was a S10 Chevy or something like that. And you know how, I don't know if this will make sense, but whenever he would sing it, he would like enunciate like the red bone part. So that's like what stuck with me in my head. But I, you know, don't remember him saying Melungeon part of the song. So, I mean, I think for me, it was a pretty easy like switch identity wise, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because like all, you know, my whole life, people have always asked, you know, what are you, or are you Hispanic or whatever? And, you know, before then, all, you know, had to say was, you know, just Cherokee, because that's all I had ever been told. But then once I figured that out, I was, you know, it just didn't feel right to keep like claiming Cherokee, even though I, you know, had no documentation or whatever. So it was a pretty easy like move from, you know, Cherokee to Melungeon.
Right, right. So you briefly mentioned it, but we're going to go into it. Your primary areas of research are on Appalachian folklore and folk magic.
Yes.
What are the significance of each, both folklore and folk magic?
Well, folklore is basically like the, to me, it's the makeup of a people's story. So it's made up of like their history, where they come from, what has occurred, how tied it is with the land. Whereas the folk magic is sort of the byproduct of the folklore. It is the, like the meeting point between religion and medicine, and it's fueled by the necessities that, you know, the daily life back then, you know, called for, whether it was, you know, making sure that the crops grew in, or making sure that, you know, somebody who, you know, just got a cold or whatever didn't die because of it. Because, you know, one death could, you know, decimate an entire family. Especially if they were like a, you know, one of the people bringing bread into the home.
So how has your unique Cherokee and Melungeon ancestry influenced your study and practice of Appalachian folk magic?
Well, I mean, with my father's side of the family always, you know, tell me the Cherokee stories and take me to powwows, combined with my mother's Baptist family. I mean, it kind of melts together kind of easily, because my mother's side of the family, theirs wasn't like a by the book type of Christianity. It was more like a day by day, I guess I would call it, and a lot more like animistic and fluid rather than like just stagnant. So it kind of like paired together pretty easily in the development of my mind.
Now, how do you feel Appalachian folk magic differs from other forms of folk magic?
Well, first and foremost, because of its makeup through the history of the people who, you know, came into the region, whether it was the Scotch-Irish, the British, French, German, you know, so on and so forth. And, you know, how that kind of melded together with, you know, local Cherokee practices as well as African-American practices.
We're going to talk a little more about your books later, but when you just mentioned about the European, African, and Indigenous, in your books, you discuss the intersections between European, African, and Indigenous traditions that led to an unique Appalachian traditions. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on this?
Yeah, well, the best way, comparison that I can explain it in is, like, you have, you know, Deep South Hoodoo, which is primarily, you know, African-American folk magic from, like, Louisiana, New Orleans, that type of area. The biggest difference is, again, through its history and the folklore that influenced it. Because down in Louisiana, you had, you know, different Native tribes influencing it, as well as a hefty amount of French influence as well. Whereas in Appalachia, the majority of the influence came from the Scotch-Irish and the Cherokee. And then that, you know, leads further into the differing histories of, you know, each region, you know, in relation to the slave trade. Because down in Louisiana, you know, the region was majority Catholic. So, you know, they were easily able to, you know, hide their practices or whatever within the Catholic Church. So that's why you see a lot of works with the saints, you know, as a kind of like a mask for the law, especially in Louisiana voodoo. Whereas in Appalachia, the biggest religious, you know, belief was, you know, just like Protestant and Baptist. I think a little bit of Methodist. So there wasn't much room for, you know, those African-American practices to be passed down. Because in Appalachia, anything that was, they basically believed that anything that the black man did was of the devil. As we can even see in one of the Melungeon myths where, you know, Melungeons are said to be the children of the devil. So, I mean, it's like in Appalachia, history took a different route. Most of the remnants of African-American belief that can be found in Appalachian folk magic is within foot track magic. And I don't think there's an actual term for it, but it's like the array of outdoor decorations, like a bunch of statues and, oh, bird baths, you know, that type of thing, as well as grave decorating.
And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned, I was going to mention about, because I've run across it in my research, about the Melungeon people were mythologized as boogeymen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people would tell their children that the Melungeons were going to come and get them. You know, I was going to ask you if you had come across any of that, and, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, Appalachian folk magic, just like anything else in America, was not left untouched by racism or exoticism, because there's a lot of, you know, old recipes, you know, that call for certain things simply based on the amount of melanin in a person's skin. And, you know, we can see the same apply to Melungeons with the belief that, you know, if you went into Melungeon territory and, you know, you didn't get dogs or anything sicked on you, then within a couple of days, you may waste away from an unknown disease, which, you know, everywhere else in the South was called unnatural illness, which was like a magical illness that was, it was basically like a curse to make you waste away, like from the waist up or anything like that.
Oh, wow. All right, Jake, let's discuss your published books, Backwoods Witchcraft, Conjure and Folk Magic from Appalachia, and your most recent, Doctoring the Devil, Notebooks of an Appalachian Conjure Man. Please give us an overview of each title.
Well, Backwoods Witchcraft basically like introduces you to the actual practice of the region, while also explaining how the practice is rooted in not only the geography of the region itself, but also the biodiversity that can be found in the region in both plants and animals, and how, you know, within, you know, the mountainous regions of southern Appalachia, how the mountains shaped and molded not only history, but also the course of individual people's lives. Because, I mean, the mountains, you know, they affect our weather. They basically control the weather. It's like a little, like, basin, and you'll have, like, little microclimates, you know, here and there. You know, on one side of the mountain, it'll, you know, always mostly be sunny and a little bit rainy, whereas on the other side, yeah, it's always cloudy and, you know, foggy and everything like that. And then, you know, that further, you know, expands into how Appalachia, which was called the Endless Forest during the, you know, the first days of colonization, you know, it kind of, it not only stoked, like, praise in, like, the beauty of creation, but it also stoked fear in the unknown, you know, because, you know, you had panthers, wolves, all kinds of things back then, you know, before they went extinct. So that just furthered man's fear of the unknown, which furthered, you know, the folkloric, you know, stories that they would tell about the region or whatever they saw in the woods or whatever they thought they saw peeking at them from behind a tree.
So can you share some common Appalachian folk traditions with us?
Well, there are a few recipes throughout Appalachia that are what I would say are the extremely like they're the most common throughout the entire region. And those are, you know, usually recipes for stopping the flow of blood, usually with a Bible verse, but sometimes with just like the swiping of a hand over the wound. I think I even found one recipe where the person doctoring the other person is to just blow on it and then the blood stops. And then the others were like wart charming, whether it was buying someone's wart from them using a shiny dime, a piece of potato, a piece of bacon, a string, a thorn. They literally used anything that they had, whether it was pricking the wart, rubbing the wart, tying the wart off, as well as measuring rites, which is basically where, like, if a child has asthma, you would take him to somebody who, you know, had the gift, and they would take a stick. Sometimes the stick is specified to be like sourwood, birch, willow, something like that. And they would cut it the same length of the child, or the same height rather. And then they would, you know, measure the child with the stick, and then they would either, you know, throw the stick in the woods or hide it up in like the rafters of the cabin, or, you know, in an attic somewhere. And it was said that once the child outgrew the measurement of the stick, then they would likewise outgrow the asthma or whatever other ailment they were being doctored for.
Jake, I have heard of the wart charming, by the way, in my family. Yes. So are there any that are specific to Melungeons that you know of?
Well, the only ones that I've come across really is like throwing a silver coin into like a newborn baby's, I believe it's their first bath, will ensure good luck in their first years. And then a tradition of always putting tobacco on the riverbank when you're fishing so that the river spirits don't follow you home and try to steal the fish back. And then, of course, the one in reference to Melungeon grave houses about a, yes, you know, like a spirit that would slip into the grave and disturb the dead. But it seems that piece of folklore is, you know, so old that the rest of it's been forgotten. Like, what kind of spirit? Why would it do that? Or any other information like that. You know, Melungeons, they were, I mean, their culture was like majority Appalachian as well. So, you know, you would see the same works among them as you would in greater Anglo-Appalachia. So, you know, they still followed the same, you know, little quirky rites of like measuring, blood stopping, wart charming, and you can even see it in Drongul's writings, if they can be believed, where she was offered a necklace of blood beads, which reminds me of a red corn necklace that I was handed down that was supposed to be for nosebleeds.
So, Jake, the red corn beads, is that connected to the Cherokee traditions or indigenous traditions?
Not that I have found.
Okay.
The reference that Drumgul makes is the closest that I have been able to find in reference to any kind of red beads being used to, like, either stop the blood or being good for the blood in general.
Okay.
And I actually talk about it in Backwoods. I mean, it's like I don't know how they did it. It was like, I guess they soaked the corn kernels first or something like that, but they're like sewn onto like just like little brittle sewing thread. So I mean, it's basically about to fall apart.
That's fascinating. I had not heard of that one. Okay, I'm sure that our listeners would love to learn more. Where can they purchase your books? And do you have a website and social media accounts they can follow?
Yeah, they can find it on Amazon.com or at their local Barnes & Noble or just on the Barnes & Noble website. And they can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook.
Excellent. All right. Well, Jake, we want to thank you so much for joining us today on the Melungeon Voices podcast. And it was great talking to you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Melungeon Voices podcast. On behalf of myself, Heather Andalina, and the entire MHA Executive Committee, we'd like to thank all of those who participated in making this episode possible. For more information, you can visit them on the web at melungeon.org. That's melungeon.org. The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast episode do not necessarily represent those of the MHA. Melungeon Voices is presented by the Melungeon Heritage Association. All rights are reserved.